Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugrupul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombameri, Noonuccal, Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. Welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, we've got a guest on the phone from the Northern Territory, Scott McConnell. And Scott is the CEO of the Ngerika Outstations Resource Services, joining me today via telephone. Scott, welcome to the program. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, Tiger, and good morning, listeners.
Whereabouts are you situated at the moment?
I'm sitting in lovely Alice Springs. We've had a nice couple of cool days, but it's getting proper hot again. So we'll be looking forward to a few days over 40 in Alice in the next few days.
Tell me about Ngerika.
Ngerika is an Aboriginal corporation formed about 30 years ago to look after outstations. As you know, there's been, you know, all over Australia, but particularly in the desert country, a strong move for people wanting to go back to country. And a lot of people have gone back onto small outstations in Central Australia. And Ngerika is a service provider that helps to make good and sustainable life on those outstations. And as we know, there's been a lot of reports and things, but also we know from working every day that outstations are a really good place for Indigenous people to live, work and be educated and be healthy.
How long have you been engaged with this organisation?
I've been here for about 8 years, but my history is that I was brought up in Central Australia and lived and worked with Aboriginal people on cattle stations and national parks all my life.
All right. Your schooling then, similar situation in that surrounded by First Nations mob?
Yeah, I grew up among the Yamaja people, which are the next language group north of Alice Springs. And I learned back in good old days of stock camps with horses and everything, you know, before the helicopters and road trains. So I was really, really lucky to spend a lot of time with a lot of Aboriginal elders in them days. It was a very, very different time, you know, no TV, no telephone, no nothing, only
the good days.
Radio and that's it.
The good days, good old days.
The good days, yep.
So then I take it you'd speak a language or two?
Look, I guess, no, I don't, and it's a real problem, you know, like I should. When I was a child, I spoke Amajara really, really well. I've got a little bit of language of several different language groups, particularly Luritja and Pinjara. But I'm a white bloke from a period when white fellows were discouraged from speaking Aboriginal languages by their parents and their peers. So that's the way it was in my day, and it's regretful to me now. But I was actively discouraged from speaking Aboriginal tongue when I was a child.
What are the benefits for our mob to be back on country on outstations? What are the benefits? Why do they want to go back?
Look, I think obviously there's that very strong connection to country, and even people who may have had that, you know, weakened by, you know, generations of sort of repression through welfare and all sorts of other things, that strong kinship with country is still there in Aboriginal people, and so they really benefit, you know, spiritually, socially and emotionally from being on country. But the other thing I would say is that places like Alice Springs and, you know, to some degree other Northern Territory towns like Katherine and Norlanboy and Tennant Creek and Darwin too, they're dangerous places for Aboriginal people. They are very dangerous places. People are better off on their communities or on their outstations.
What are the dangers?
The streets are a real dangerous place. The town camps can be quite dangerous places. Public housing can be quite dangerous places. There can be quite a lot of issue between between people of Aboriginal race. But it's also, you know, I think it would be very remiss of me to not acknowledge that there's strong types of racism. You know, don't want to brand the place a racist town. That's an easy thing to do, but there is a part of the predominantly white population that treat Aboriginal people extremely poorly.
Mm. What about health benefits, diet, things like that? And then some of the challenges when they are back on country, like water, like health treatment, having to go into town, like for the dialysis and stuff like that. But what are some of the benefits health-wise for being on country?
Oh, look, one of the biggest benefits, obviously.
Sorry, mate. Yep, back with you. And some of the challenges, did we get to that?
Yeah, look, some of the challenges, I find it obviously living in the bush, travelling to and from town to access, you know, healthcare, education, work, all those types of things, the price of fuel, the maintenance of vehicles, all of those things are very, very, very expensive, and it is really, really difficult for people to juggle, to be able to stay on country. The resolve of people to do it is incredible, and their ingenuity to sustain themselves on country is, I think, a real credit to families that continue to do it. It is really, really difficult in the modern environment, and a kind of interesting. A lot of those services, those allied services, if you will, you know, like the mobile services of the, you know, the clinic coming out, to do on-site health checks, or, you know, a bit more, you know, mobile toy library to do a bit with the kids, all that sort of stuff. Even though we've had, you know, money pulka, big money thrown around by intervention and stuff, a lot of those actual things that really help families directly on the ground, those services have actually been withdrawn, not increased. That's a big problem.
Now, what are some of the things that your organisation does when people need some support? I mean, What do you assist with? Have you told us that at all?
Look, what we assist with, the Outstations Resource Services side of the business, we do other things too. We have a commercial business and other operations. But the Outstations Resource side of the business, does operate from a government grant, a Program Funding Agreement grant, which is federal money but administered by the Northern Territory Government. Now, that grant is for the purpose of supporting people. It's not enough to do everything. People have to put their hand in their own pocket as well, but it's to provide support. So we supply support around power, water, and municipal services. We also supply really limited support around housing. And, for some of those people out there that'll be thinking, oh, these mob getting something for free. They don't get something for free. Everyone pays a user fee. So there's a user pays methodology in it, and everyone contributes, and they're all happy to contribute. So it's a good system. Interestingly enough, Tiger, there's been a bit of change recently. Funding for outstations has been at risk for probably about 10 years. And, you know, it's sort of been not known very well. Minister Macklin announced about a year ago now that she had secured funding for outstations for the next 10 years using Aboriginal benefit account funds. So that's good. So we know now that there's a further 10 years of funding for the outstations. The Northern Territory Government also, the new Northern Territory Government, which of course the Country Liberal Party, the Conservative Government, they've announced some extra support for outstations. We don't fully understand that yet, but they've offered some extra support around doing things on housing. So we're looking forward to hearing more about that. And hopefully we'll hear more about that after the first session of Parliament this year.
How do people feel about Genocide Jenny, the Minister, using royalty money, the royalty money from mining, the Aboriginal Benefit Trust account. How do they feel about that?
Oh, I think people think that it's, you know, at one level, I think people feel it's a little bit disingenuous. I mean, as we know, the royalty money is Aboriginal people's money. So it's Aboriginal people's money, and then we've got, you know, the Commonwealth spending it on their behalf. Look, I think people feel, yeah, fairly incredulous about it all. I personally get concerned about, you know, what ABA continually gets used for. I think the direct link to community benefit and building capacity of individual communities and individual community members, I think it's sometimes lost by being overly bureaucratic.
Yeah, and having the minister bureaucrats just accessing that money, deciding on where that money goes, that was never the case when it was initially set up, and probably in the first 20 or 30 years was never the case. So
No, it wasn't the case. And it is something that needs to be looked at. There's clear inequity in it, in the system. And it does need to be looked at. And, from time to time it makes my blood boil, but I'm trying to be a little bit pragmatic here.
I sense that.
Yeah.
But the government has responsibility to provide infrastructure and essential services. They would do it in any other mainstream centre or town, township, but for Aboriginal people, First Nations people, it's just not on. They don't think it's right. Well, they think it's okay to take black money, and it's just not right at all. That should be controlled and decided upon by First Nations people, not by the likes of her. Anyway, how does the AMP, and now we've got the Stronger Futures legislation, how does the Stronger Futures legislation compare with the AMP, and how does it affect Ngerika or the organisation itself and the services it provides?
The direct effect on those supported services like municipal essential services and housing services, the direct effect is minimal. The major thing sort of concerns me. Look, I know people, you know, with the original intervention, I acknowledge that there are some aspects of it that people consider were positive, but you know, I never like these paternalistic approaches of taking over people's lives, and you know, to me, I think it was I respectfully say that it was martial law for blackfellas. Now, I just don't think that that's right, and it offends me morally that we're willing to pick on, you know, First Nations race of people of Australia, and you know, decide that they need these special laws. Now, it was bad enough when it was the intervention. The thing that worries me about Stronger Futures is Stronger Futures further institutionalises it. You know, the special measures of the intervention of 5 years, a lot of those special measures, most of those special measures, have been extended by the Stronger Futures legislation for a further 10 years. That completely institutionalises them. They're no longer special measures. They are now a new suite of laws that affect, you know, great swathes of the Northern Territory, and geographically, probably, you know, by percentage, a lot more than 50% are affected by these laws. To me, it's a little bit, and you know, this is going to really annoy people, but to me, it's a little bit like the suite of laws known in the American South after the American Civil War, known as the Jim Crow laws. And the Jim Crow laws were basically along the lines of, well, we recognise African American people that were slaves. We now recognise them citizens of our country, and we fought a war over their freedom, and we recognise that they're equal citizens. Now what can we do, the overall system, to start clawing back those rights? And to me, the working futures, it can be all positive, and I'm sure Prime Minister Macklin today will be telling us about how good it is and all the targets she's met. And
Prime Minister Gillard.
That Prime Minister Gillard will be saying that, you know, she's done, her government have done all these great things, and the only things that have been done poorly have been done by governments that aren't of her political persuasion. I'm sure she'll be saying all that sort of stuff. But those special measures and those institutionalisations of laws that are different to me are like the Jim Crow laws. They're actually taking away people's rights as citizens of our great nation.
Yeah. Yes, I had to quickly, hurriedly correct you, Prime Minister Macklin. No, thanks. I shudder at the thought. It's bad enough.
Sorry, mate. That was a bit, yeah, that's a bit scary, wouldn't it?
Oh, mate, scary. Let's not go there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's interesting that you mention Gillard's Close the Gap report to be released today or presented today. Particularly, I wonder whether there's any reference to, I think it was a week or two ago that the Productivity Commission report came out and figures stating that the gap with life expectancy for Aboriginal First Nations people, I'm trying to stop using Aboriginal, with First Nations people, and I don't mean for you to be doing it, mate. You use whatever you're comfortable with. It's just that for me, I don't like that word. Now, and I don't force my views on you or anybody else. The Productivity Commission figures stated that it's more than over 20 years shorter lifespan for First Nations male and female. More than 20 years. And it was only a few years ago, and I think it was under Rudd's watch, when it was reduced down to 9 years by the stroke of a pen. They'd didn't interpret their figures or something properly, you know. And I knew it was, everybody knew that was a rubbish thing to do. That was crap. And now the Productivity Commission comes out with their report. I think it's 22 or 23 years difference. Now, that's outrageous. It's criminal. And I just wait to see whether Gillard will live down to my expectations and overlook that.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. And, you know, I mean, living in Alice Springs, where there's a high percentage of an Indigenous population, a First Nations population, and then working predominantly with those people every day like I do. I can see every day the health outcomes getting worse, not better. And I think we've lost sight of the fact that you know, for people to be well, to be socially, emotionally well, to be culturally well, to be connected, you know, this is some sort of saying you see on, you know, little placards in restaurants and stuff, but it's really, really true. People need someone to love, something to do, and something to look forward to. And we've got a lot of issues. The system has really interfered in Aboriginal families and Aboriginal lives. We're continually either taking a key member of an Aboriginal family out by locking them up in jail, or we're taking a child away and putting them in welfare, or we're taking a youth away and putting them in youth detention or whatever. We're continuing to break up Aboriginal family units. We're moving them geographically all over the place. We're failing to deliver services where they want to live, so they're moving into communities that they don't fit into very well. All of these things are breaking down people's families and people's relationships of love. We've got a major problem there. The second problem that we got is that we're actually systematically taking things away from Indigenous people's lives and not involving them in making decisions over their own lives. The system knows better. You know, the government knows best. This government knows best attitude needs to be kicked out the door. So we're not involving people. People aren't participating in this system. Aboriginal people aren't participating in this position. They're just being kicked around by this system, and that's got to change. And there's just something to look forward to. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of you know, Aboriginal people that I know, they look forward to visiting their dad or auntie or whatever in the dialysis unit. They look forward to visiting their cousin or brother in jail or on the courthouse lawns. That's not something to look forward to.
That's right.
We need to look back, and we need to recognise, you know, we need to recognise that this has got to change. And you know, the couple of things that are up there now as things that the people are talking about changing is incarceration and liquor laws.
All right, we've got to touch on the alcohol restrictions too. But it's interesting, you know, those points you just made. One of my aunties, who's a regular guest on here, on this talk show, she states continually that we need to be able to look forward to a brighter future and better opportunity, more opportunities than we can see from behind us.
Yep.
So something along those lines. She says it more articulately than I can. But, yes, it's similar to what you're saying now. Another report was the Deloitte's Access Economics report released early this week. Gino Wumbucker and John Herron, former Minister for Aboriginal Affairs, Gino's the CEO of the organisation that commissioned the report, that organisation being the Australian National Council on Drugs. They were on air yesterday. Now, you've seen some of those figures, the fact that they're promoting, they're standing strong, they've got the economic argument that it is would be far better for them to, for the government, for the system, to reinvest money, to try to avoid building new jails and start building rehab centres and treatment places and treat people, especially the non-violent offenders they focus on. I'll talk about this. Just see what your thoughts are on that report. We'll have a song first. Take a short break for a song. But I think it's interesting that at long last there is that argument that there's no value, little value in locking people up, particularly non-violent offenders, and there must be other options. So there's the argument there, the financial argument, as well as the moral argument, I suppose. We'll come back and talk to you, see what your thoughts are on that report, on those comments, on those views of these people. Well, my guest today is Scott McConnell. Scott is the CEO of Ingerica Outstations Resource Services in Alice Springs. We've got a caller on the line. Will, welcome to the program. Will, I think you're our Bumabipra Media, our BBM Cairns listener, are you not, Will?
Absolutely, yeah.
Good to have you engaged, mate. What would you like to say?
Great to be back. Oh, look, just to endorse the comments that have been made that the powers are taken away from people, and any common sense thinking person understands that people aren't given responsibility and not given decisions over their own destiny, then we're probably going to not have a positive result, are we? I think back to Mr. Perkins, you know, and he was post Martin Luther King, and how like Martin Luther King, by so many people, he was hated, but he got the results, didn't he? And that seems to be the answer. I mean, people have to take responsibility for their own destiny. When you look at Dr. King, he really stood up against the odds. Everybody knows this, just how challenging that was. And I think everybody experiences difficulty in their lives to a greater or lesser degree, although I think very few people in a majority really understand the emotion of what it is to be a minority and to experience racial prejudice. Until someone's experienced racial prejudice, they really can't even begin to comprehend the emotion that goes with that. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, mate, race, discrimination, well, racism and stuff, it's a bit like sexism. We as males, and this is something my mother pointed out to me, of course, I wasn't smart enough to think of it myself, it took a woman to tell me, and a black woman at that. But my mother said to me, she said, racism is like sexism. With sexism, we as males did not easily identify or identify at all sexist language, behaviour. She said it was the females whom it was directed to that were able to identify it and bring it to the attention of the males. Racism, if you're not a person of colour, it's very difficult for you to identify the subtleties of racism and the way things happen. So, yeah, I do agree with you somewhat, yes. Thank you very much for your call, mate.
Yeah, you're welcome. Great to be able to talk to you again. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. You have a good day. That's Will from Cairns. Bummer Bipra Media, BBM up there. They're a deadly mob, too, they are. That crew at BBM. Jackie and Ben and the crew. And not to mention Trendy Trev, they're the talk show host up there. Good morning to you all. And all your listeners in that area, you do a great job. Now, Scott, what was I going to talk about? The alcohol, it wasn't the alcohol restrictions, it was Gino Wumbacher and the Deloitte's Access Economics Report, where a big, strong recommendation coming out, and I see today it's supported by Warren Snowden, Minister for Health, or Minister for Indigenous Health. Snowden's coming out saying he supports the push or the statement, the recommendation that non-violent offenders should be looked at, should be treated differently, First Nations, non-violent offenders, and look at rehabilitation. Look at money being spent on keeping these people out of jail. Jail should be a last resort, is what came out of the discussion yesterday with the CEO and the chairperson of the Australian the Australian National Council on Drugs. You've heard of the report, seen some comments, maybe seen some of the comments on this report. What are your thoughts when they talk in this way? John Heron said there should be a prohibition on building new jails. I mean, by gee, great statement to make. I certainly support that one. What are your thoughts on that? Those comments and that report?
Yeah, look, I absolutely agree with the findings of the report and endorse, you know, all of the comments that have been made about how important it is to keep people out of jail. I think that, you know, like, yeah, especially government mob and, you know, all that, you got to give them something that's, you know, got a dollar figure and what they're going to save and all that. But to me, what's far more important here is that the main people that are being removed out of the community and put in jail or incarcerated are people that if circumstances were slightly different and if resources were used differently, they could actually be the strong leadership of the community. So we're taking out you know, a lot of them are males, but there's a lot of women going to jail now too. That's a really worrying trend. We're taking out the people that are in the prime of their life, you know, sort of 18, 19 up to, you know, 40-something. And I'm 40-something, so I've still got to be in the prime of my life. I'll just keep extending it when I'm 50-something in primary life.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. But no, we're taking out those key people and locking them up. And for what benefit? We can see it's not working. Recidivism rates in the territory of these types of offenders are extraordinarily high. I don't have the figures in front of me, but they're extraordinarily high. So we can see this shit don't work. Sorry, excuse my language. But we can see this approach don't work. So it really is time to look at it. We do need community-controlled rehabilitation programs. They're key, and we must be listening to the community and about what the community think there needs to be. Obviously, there has to be a meeting in the middle, and we've got to make sure that these diversion or these rehabilitation programs don't start to look more like a reward than capacity building. But they don't need to be punishment. We don't need to punish people. We don't want to reward people either. What we want to do is we want to educate people and to try and reduce the recidivism. So I'm really excited about the report, and I'm really excited about the support that's coming out. Members of the Northern Territory Government have come out in support of it, and it's good to hear that Warren, our local federal member, has come out to support it as well. That's very good to hear.
It certainly is encouraging, and let's hope something comes of it. And something may well come of it when they state quite specifically the dollar cost and the outcomes, the results, and how they could get much better results with a focus on spending money in other areas, like trying to get jail being a last resort instead of the first option. It could well be that we could see some real change. Let's hope so.
Yes, absolutely.
Today we've got the Prime Minister giving her report or her on the anniversary of the apology. I think the apology is next week. But she's giving her report, Close the Gap report. It's like a report card on First Nations affairs. But she's already been quoted as mentioning the rivers of grog. I mean, how dare this woman utter those words, rivers of grog? Firstly, they were brought out by that other, another bloke that's no longer around, and neither should he be, Mal Brough, although he's making a comeback, and probably will make some sort of a comeback. But things aren't looking real good for him. He's been in, Anyway, rivers of grog. What a ridiculous, sensationalised manner in describing the alcohol issue with First Nations communities. This brings into opens the door for the discussion on alcohol restrictions in the territory. What do you say? What are your thoughts? How do you feel about things?
Look, I'm a strong believer that there is a very strong evidence base to say that prohibition doesn't work. And so I'm opposed to anything that looks like prohibition. And I'm opposed to laws that are obviously directed to a certain sector of the community. So this really bothers me. Now, I think some of this stuff, you know, like it's interesting as a community member in Alice Springs. It's really interesting to watch the discussions about how the Aboriginal people drink too much grog that are quite often take place over some Chardonnay or perhaps some imported beer. You know, alcohol is a big problem in our community, particularly among youth in the mainstream Australian community. We have a major grog problem. We see it in its worst on, you know, the streets of our big cities where there's people going proper silly on grog. Grog is a big problem in our community. It's a bigger problem in parts of the Aboriginal community, I acknowledge. But to go and make all these special laws that are directed at people and, you know, make these sweeping statements like river and grog and stuff, grow up and respect these people that are consuming the alcohol. They are people and they have rights.
What is there any indication of change or new laws coming in, the alcohol restrictions? What specifically are these restrictions?
Look, in the Northern Territory, and part of this is in the Northern Territory, what major change that we had is all Aboriginal land, that's Aboriginal land trusts held under the Northern Territory Land Rights Act, all Aboriginal land trusts, every square inch of them were declared dry by the intervention. And they're being maintained dry by the Stronger Futures legislation. So that means that every skerrick of land and a lot more than 50% of the Northern Territory is held under that instrument, the Northern Territory Land Rights Act. Despite the Northern Territory land, it's actually a federal piece of legislation. So the vast majority of land is declared dry. So look, what happens is that poor buggers can be going somewhere, community mob, and they'll get pulled up on the edge of town. Where are you going? I'm going to Tea Tree. Our Tea Tree's on a dry community. They tip the grog out on the side of the road. Policemen do. So the poor buggers, they can go and spend their money, buy the grog at the takeaway bottle shop, who do really well out of this, thank you very much. They drive 15 kilometres up the road, get stopped by the police and get their grog tipped out on the side of the road. This is wrong. This is separatist activity. This is driving a wedge between the predominantly white part of the community and the Indigenous community. It is wrong, it is unhelpful, and it needs to stop.
Yes, it's quite disappointing that police are not just in the Territory. It's happened, and you can see it happen here in West End. They claim they have the power. They have laws under which they act to search people. Just recently, towards the end of last year, one of our more well-known members of the First Nations community over on the East Coast, Graceland Smallwood, was pulled up walking up to Musgrave Park from West End, pulled up on the street, just walking along. They wanted to search her bag and everything for grog. So it's not just the territory that it's happening. Police are out of control. Some police are out of control right across the country when it comes down to First Nations people, and it just isn't right.
Tiger, one thing that's interesting here, and this has been a hobby horse of mine for a long, long time. One thing that's interesting here is that you can now all Aboriginal land is declared dry, so possessing or consuming alcohol eventually leads to imprisonment on Aboriginal land. So that's all of these communities, you know, Papunya, Hassbluff, Mount Liebig, Santa Teresa, Kintore, Docker River, Mampo, et cetera, all dry. So all of the people that live on those communities are not allowed to consume alcohol. That's it, bang, they're breaking the law. And breaking the law, consuming alcohol, is probably one of the first things that'll put them on the road to prison. So that's the first one there. Now, if you go to the Alice Springs Town Camps, or Urban Living Areas, as they prefer to call them now under their rebranded name, they are declared dry by federal legislation. So there is 280 homes on those on the Alice Springs Town Camps. On those Alice Springs Town Camps, it is illegal to possess or consume alcohol. People do it all the time, and it's another, you know, first step to the road to the big house, Greenbush, as people call it, to jail. So that's a problem there. Now, public housing, ordinary public housing properties in the Northern Territory, people have the option, they call it an option, but what they do is they look at you and you have a darker hue, and basically they say you're going to declare your place dry. So the public housing properties, and a lot of Indigenous people in the Northern Territory live in public housing in towns like Alice Springs, a fair degree of those public housing properties are declared dry as well. So what ends up...
By the Housing Authority?
By the Housing Authority. So they've got a special piece of legislation, and they'll all tell you, especially the previous government, all tell you, oh, but people choose to be dry. Yeah, yeah, whatever.
You think they may be coerced or influenced heavily?
I believe they're coerced. Now, people are going to, you know, say that I'm, you know, blah, 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 whatever, but I believe they're coerced. So look, my main point is that the issue is that where these people live, they are almost certain to not be allowed to legally consume alcohol. Now, also in the Northern Territory, you're not allowed to consume alcohol in public places. Most of the towns are declared dry. So if you go and drink in a public park or something, same like you were talking about for Queensland, they can search your bag and tip it out and all that. You see backpackers walking down the road with grog all the time. They never get it tipped out. It's only the poor bugger Aboriginal mob that get it tipped out. So you see that problem all the time. So all the public places. And then, yeah, there's a couple of the famous animal bars in Alice Springs, and, you know, if anybody really wants to deal with liquor problems in Alice Springs, they should close them animal bars. These are the really disgusting bars that target just Indigenous drinkers. I think they're abhorrent places. But they're the only places that Aboriginal people are comfortable in. All the mainstream town pubs, they don't make people real welcome. They don't actively, you know, say you're black, you can't come in, but you know what it's like. You go in, you sit down, they look at you, they don't make you comfortable. So my problem is that people can go and buy the grog. You can go and buy the grog, no problem at all. Then you try and consume it, and the police come and tip you out and start you on a journey towards jail. That's wrong. That is absolutely wrong.
Sure is.
It's entrapment, isn't it?
It is. It's definitely entrapment. But it's just unbelievable that we can talk about these things, and doesn't seem to be too many people that call this place home and happen to be of the dominant culture, settler society, are too keen to speak out about it or anything. They seem to sit back and be a bit quiet, which is rather sad, because until people stand up, until people speak out, they're condoning these atrocities that take place. While you sit and be silent, you're condoning it and saying it's okay. And I'm sure a lot of people of the dominant culture don't think it's right, because there are basic human rights. We have rights, all of us, regardless of colour and creed, race. But I think just too many people in this country are a little frightened, a little hesitant, don't want to talk about it. It's rather sad.
Yeah, it is rather sad. And one of the things that I'm... I'm I really, you know, I'm a very proud Australian. But one of the reasons I'm a very proud Australian is I'm very proud of the living and breathing First Nations culture that we have in our country. Where I was lucky enough to be brought up has really heavily influenced what makes me up as a person. I think what we have to work on, all of us together that share the aspiration to see a better lot for Indigenous Australians. I think what we need to do is we've got to work. Unfortunately, everybody, you know, by being human, people end up being fairly self-interested. So what we probably need to do, I think, better collectively, all of those people that want to improve this situation, is to make sure that we bring greater relevance to Indigenous culture, to all Australians. We should all be very proud of our Indigenous culture in Australia. We should be celebrating it a lot more than we do. And this is something that's got me worried now, with even things like, you know, the Prime Minister's statement today, you know.
All right. Okay. It's really good to hear, man. And there are, like I say, there are a number of people out there in the dominant culture that do feel similar to yourself and are prepared to have a crack and make a statement, make a stand. But far too many sit back and be silent. I've got a caller on the line, Roachie, one of our regulars. Roachie, welcome to the program. What would you like to say, mate?
Yeah, mate, parliamentarians don't care about their bill for the grog and things like that that you and I have got to pay for. But why take civil liberties away from people like that up there and make it like that? Government can go ahead and do what they like, but you can't. But why not try and stop them from drinking the grog when they go all these dues and things and overseas?
Yeah, they can sit.
We're paying for it.
You're right. We're paying for it. Yes. No, it's just not right, mate. Certainly agree with you there.
You know what I mean? I've been to Northern Territory and seen what goes on. You can buy grog everywhere, but as you say, if you walk out of a place with it, the police take it. But do the police take it and drink it themselves, or do they try and pay?
No, generally they tip it out on the ground, as the brother has said, the guest has said, that tip it on the ground in front of you, which hurts a bit more. You mightn't mind if they take it. You mightn't mind so much if they take it and drink it too, but anyway.
Yeah, well, if you pay for it, you should be allowed to drink it.
That's right, mate. Hey, thanks for your call, buddy. Right.
Well, I'll leave it to you.
Good on you, Roachie. Thanks, mate.
Bye.
Yes. There's one mainstream Australian fella out there that doesn't like what's going on, that's for sure, and he's not frightened to ring in and speak his piece. Thanks, Roachie. What could people do, Scott? What could people do? In regards to a lot of these issues that you talk about today, and it's not just in the Northern Territory, it's happening across the country in varying degrees, and not all just to First Nations people. There are other marginalised groups that are copping the rough end of the stick and mistreated and stuff. But what can people do generally? Would you encourage them to do something, or just sit back and continue as they do nothing?
Look, I would encourage people to advocate for less separatism and less collectivism. So specifically what I mean there is I don't think there's benefit to be having all these things that make people separate. So laws, they'll say that, you know, they've reinstated the Racial Discrimination Act and they've done this and they've done that, and the laws around restrictions of alcohol are for everyone or whatever. But, you know, we're not that silly. We can look and see that there's instruments in here that are targeting people, you know, and that's why, you know, everyone's backed off on recognising First Nations people in the Constitution, because they're really worried that they won't be able to do these things and manipulate the system the way they do now. So that's why they're so scared of it. So we got to stop doing these things that are separate, and we got to have, you know, we recognise and celebrate that we are, you know, if we understand that we're mainly the same, we can celebrate our differences rather than fear them. So I'd like to see a lot more people advocate a lot more for a lot more working together rather than working separately. I think that that would be really, really important. And I think we need to get rid of collectivism and get rid of collectivism completely. You know, this idea that we're going to make instruments to treat Aboriginal people collectively different because there's some individuals with problems, let's get away from it. Nobody, that's got to stop. So if we can advocate for those sorts of things, I think that is really, really important. And another thing I'd like, you know, like somebody here said, somebody I really quite respect in Alice Springs said to me, if somebody says something that you don't like about, you know, these issues, that you need to stand up for it. And I thought about it, I thought, you know, he's absolutely right. If you're at a barbecue in somebody's backyard and they make some comment that is ill-informed, take the time to correct them and take the time to say, I don't respect that opinion, or I don't think that opinion's fair. Or if you're not comfortable with doing that, just walk away, because being involved in those things and not doing anything about it, it's a really short walk from there to being complicit in their actions. So just be mindful all the time and be careful. And if people are, you know, if people are making some little remark that they think is a joke that is clearly racist and is clearly ill-informed, if it's the appropriate situation, take the person on. If it's not appropriate to take them on, walk away.
Yeah, for sure.
Don't put up with it.
All right. And others can they can get on the internet, send emails, write letters, or make a phone call to their local members and people that have been elected to do a better job than what they're doing or what the voters are expecting. They vote them in. Don't just leave them sit there. Keep them accountable.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, mate. We're getting close to news time. Thank you very much for joining us today. It's great to catch up with you again, and we will talk again before too long.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Good on you, mate. Keep up the good work up there.
Cheers, mate.
Talk to you later. Bye now. Scott McConnell joining us there. And Scott is the CEO of Ingerica Outstations Resource Services. 30 years that organisation's been around. Isn't that fantastic? 30 years. What an achievement. And to be working and supporting our mob countrymen going out onto country, setting up those outstations and stuff. Tomorrow I've got a guest talking to me, Tony Bauer. Tony Bauer's a First Nations man that's been working with medical marijuana for many, 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 many years. Tony's a good mate, I've known for some time, and is extracting, tincture, marijuana tincture, but it's medical marijuana. And he was busted there again with a little crop. But medical marijuana is a big issue, big thing, a lot of benefits. Stay tuned tomorrow for that one. It's time for the news, and join me tomorrow for Let's Talk.